Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Brazil turns left as voters tap Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva to replace Jair Bolsonaro. Plus, Israelis face familiar choices as they prepare to head to the polls tomorrow.
This is Israel's fifth election since April 2019. And the thing is, after four elections, there are no real issues left to be debated.
And as carbon capture projects take off, we'll look at how they stash greenhouse gas. It's Monday, October 31st. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal. And here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Brazil's leftist former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, or simply Lula to his supporters, defeated conservative incumbent Jair Bolsonaro in the country's closest presidential race in history on Sunday. Journal correspondent Luciana Magalhães has more on da Silva's plans, which include pledges to increase the minimum wage and spending on the poor.
He said he will defend the Amazon, he will fight extreme poverty, he will try to reestablish ties with the international community, but he will definitely face several challenges. The country is not growing as much as when he was president between 2003 and 2010. Many Brazilians also reject Mr. da Silva, as he was accused of corruption, which he denies.
Da Silva's win marks an extraordinary comeback for a man who was in jail just 3 years ago, and it cements Latin America's shift to the political left. When da Silva takes office on January 1st, every major country in Latin America, from Argentina to Mexico, will be led by a leftist government. Russian forces have launched a barrage of strikes in Kyiv and across Ukraine that knocked out electricity and water supplies in part of the country today as the Kremlin intensified its attacks on Ukraine's civilian infrastructure. The strikes come after a drone attack on the occupied Black Sea port of Sevastopol on Saturday. Moscow blamed the attack on Ukraine and said the wreckage proved it was mounted with British assistance, a claim the UK denies. In response to the Saturday attack, Russia said it was suspending participation in an agreement that allowed Ukraine to resume its exports of grain via the Black Sea, saying that Moscow cannot provide security guarantees for civilian dry cargo vessels in the area. Despite Russia's withdrawal from the agreement, officials from Turkey, Ukraine, and the United Nations agreed on a plan for 16 vessels to transit the Black Sea today. We are exclusively reporting that industrial conglomerate Emerson Electric is selling a majority stake in its climate technologies business to investment firm Blackstone. The transformational deal for Emerson would value the unit at $14 billion, including debt, and mark the biggest private equity buyout in months, at a time when such activity has been choked off by market volatility. The deal is expected to be announced today. Twitter has drafted plans for broad layoffs as a part of a whirlwind several days in which new boss Elon Musk fired top executives, saying it was for cause, sought to reassure users and advertisers about content moderation, and continued to embrace jokes and controversies on the site. According to a person familiar with the plans, the proposed layoffs under consideration by Musk are expected to reduce engineering positions as well as affect other areas at the company. Twitter has roughly 7,500 employees, according to a disclosure earlier this year. The full scale of the cuts couldn't be determined. And in other market news, China has reported that factory, construction, and service activity all tumbled into contraction territory in October. And looking ahead, it is Fed week, with the U.S. central bank likely to raise its benchmark lending rate by another 0.75 percentage point on Wednesday. The idea of putting carbon dioxide into the ground isn't a new one. Carbon capture and sequestration projects have been operational for decades. But what is new is the pace of new activity in the sector, as well as the diversity of approaches being used, including turning CO2 into stone in order to reduce the risk of it ever escaping back into the atmosphere. Wall Street Journal climate and science reporter Eric Kneeler has been tracking the carbon sequestration industry around the world, and he joins us now with an update on its development. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Luke. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So you profile in your recent reporting one carbon sequestration project in the works off the coast of Norway, which is aiming to be the world's biggest effort to store CO2 underground. Tell us a bit more about that project.
Sure. So the project is called Northern Lights. This is a joint venture with three big energy firms and the Norwegian government. And what they're planning to do is collect carbon dioxide from different industrial sources, putting them on a ship and taking the ship all the way to the coast of Norway near Bergen, where it's collected and put in a pipeline. From there, the pipeline goes out to sea 65 miles and then about a mile and a half deep underneath the seafloor. And so underneath the seafloor, there are geologic formations where you can store the CO2 and it won't come back up to the surface into the ocean or into the atmosphere.
Just stepping back, how is this industry doing in terms of overall growth? Are we seeing it now attract significant funding? Are there a lot of projects in the works?
Right now, there are about 200 carbon capture and sequestration projects around the world. Most of these are smaller projects. These big mega projects, like the one in Norway, another one in Iceland, and there are a couple that are happening here in the United States, in Texas and Louisiana, that are just getting underway. These are much bigger. The size of the investment is much larger. The Norway project is over $2.5 billion. So things are definitely on the upswing.
Though from your reporting, Eric, it sounds like there is some concern that too much of a focus on carbon sequestration could be sort of a distraction.
One thing that some scientists are worried about is that if we put all our money and technology into capturing and sequestering CO2, then we're not going to put our money and technology and science into getting rid of it in the first place. As one scientist told me, it's a lot easier not to make a mess than it is to clean it up afterwards.
That was Wall Street Journal climate and science reporter Eric Kneeler. Eric, thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up, Israelis head to the polls tomorrow for the fifth election in 4 years. We'll get an update on what's at stake in the vote after the break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Could Israeli politician Benjamin Netanyahu be on the verge of a political comeback? Tomorrow, Israeli voters will help to decide whether Netanyahu deserves a sixth chance to serve as prime minister. But with the polls tight, the most likely outcome of Israel's elections could be yet another divided government, with both main political coalitions struggling to cobble together a stable government. Dove Lieber is the Wall Street Journal's correspondent covering Israel and the Palestinian territories, and he joins us now with a preview of tomorrow's vote. Hey, Dove, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Luke.
You bet. So remind us why we're here in the first place with Israel holding yet another election now.
Okay, so this is Israel's fifth election since April 2019. Now, the last election created a government that was made up of eight different parties, left-wing parties, centrist parties, right-wing parties, and for the first time ever in Israel's history, independent Arab-Israeli party. That coalition was united really only in its opposition to Benjamin Netanyahu, and they didn't really have much similarities in terms of ideology, and they fought bitterly over issues regarding religion and state and on the question of policy towards the Palestinians, essentially. And it had a slim majority, so 61 lawmakers out of Israel's 120 lawmakers in its parliament. And once one right-wing lawmaker defected, the House of Cards tumbled down very quickly. And now Israel's heading to another election.
Dov, so who is this election pitting? And is there anything notable about the specific coalitions and figures who are vying for control here?
So it's all a lot of familiar faces, minus one new popular figure, I'd say, Netanyahu's coalition, a new rising force on the right, a man called Itamar Ben-Gvir, who was kind of obscure until about a year ago, and he was best known for defending Israeli settlers accused of committing violent crimes against Palestinians. Today, he's one of the most popular politicians in the country, and his party could be the third largest in Israel's parliament after the elections. In many ways, the story of the whole election has shifted from should Netanyahu lead the government to how powerful will this one lawmaker be if Netanyahu wins the election. So that means his rivals are in large part campaigning against Mr. Netanyahu's coalition partners rather than Netanyahu himself. And the other way around, Mr. Netanyahu is once again campaigning against his rivals' cooperation with different Arab parties who he calls terrorist supporters because some of their statements in support of Palestinian militants.
Dov, is that surprising? It sort of makes it seem like there aren't other political issues that might be deciding this vote.
The thing is, after four elections, there are no real issues left to be debated. That is, I mean, there's issues of inflation is kind of a new issue in the country, but both sides don't really have major arguments as to different economic plans. And really, the most important thing about this election is it's just about one thing. It's about breaking that tie, that 60-60 tie. And how do you break a tie in an election? You make sure more of your voters come out than the other side. This has been the central message of each campaign. That person, you don't want them to be in government, then you need to come vote. And ultimately, it could come down to the Arab minority here in Israel, who are 21% of the country, but who regularly vote in far less numbers than their Jewish neighbors. And if they have a large showing, they could prevent Mr. Netanyahu from reaching a majority. If they have a showing that is, or they have a low voter turnout, then they could potentially help Mr. Netanyahu reach his majority. We're just going to have to wait to see what the turnout looks like.
Okay, so maybe not a lot of issues really being invoked by politicians to try to sway voters in this home stretch of the election, but that's different from the issues a government, once elected, would actually face in power. Give us a preview of what those might be.
That's correct. The last government fell because it had a slim majority of 61 lawmakers. In the best case scenario, one side will have the exact same thing. And then when you have a majority of just one lawmaker, it means that what they say, every lawmaker becomes a king in the coalition. Every single lawmaker can request whatever they want. And that is a recipe for instability. And the Palestinians are on the losing side of this political instability. Because in a time of political instability, no one can make any major moves on the Palestinian issue that would basically take down their government. And now the issue of Russia and Ukraine, this is a much different issue, in fact, because most of the country, there's a consensus, even between Netanyahu and his rivals, that Israel cannot supply Ukraine with offensive weaponry because that would be too much of an overstep in terms of its relationship with Russia. It needs some kind of cordial relations with Russia because Russia is in its backyard in Syria. So no matter which government is in power, Israel's policy, whatever it will likely be a policy of consensus, not one of division.
Dov Lieber is the Wall Street Journal's correspondent covering Israel and the Palestinian territories. Dov, thank you.
Thank you guys for having me.
And finally, does the phrase revenge bedtime procrastination ring a bell? It refers to the phenomenon of staying up later and later into the night, even though you know you may suffer the next day. A recent study by scientists at the University of Arkansas among patients who had sought help for behavioral health issues reported a link between bedtime procrastination and anxiety. The lead author of the study said the habit could be a form of avoidance for those who worried about problems they might face the next day or who are fearful they'll have trouble falling asleep. And while sleep experts say that bedtime procrastination became more common during the pandemic, as many people felt a loss of control over their health, safety, and time, Wall Street Journal personal health reporter Alex Janin explains that for some, a return to normal has only made the habit worse.
So as people resume working, socializing in person, go back to their busy activities, we may be actually having less decompression time and conscious rest time, as some psychologists call it, during the day for ourselves. So we're so much surrounded by work and people that it may be even more likely that the only time we have to ourselves is after we get home, maybe after we've already had dinner and we're lying in bed. And that's really the only time that we can have, quote unquote, me time.
And that's What's News for Monday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.